This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from WMRA this past week. I'm Bob Levity, WMRA's news director. A little more than a week ago, the Center for Open Science, a Charlottesville-based technology company, published a landmark analysis on scientific replication. It was called the Reproducibility Project. As WMRA's Carol Lofton reported, it's much harder to replicate original research, at least in the social sciences, than you might think.
The question the study sought to answer is this: how reproducible are psychological studies? The answer is not as simple as you might think. Over the course of 4 years, the Center for Open Science recruited 270 researchers who attempted to replicate 100 psychological studies. These replicators worked in consultation with the psychologist who published the original studies to try and imitate the original as closely as possible. Even with this provision, only 39 out of the 100 studies were successfully replicated.
Research tends to be more nuanced than it might seem at first glance.
That was Johanna Cohoon, one of the project managers for the Reproducibility Project.
Conducting these extra replications, looking further into the line of research, allows you to say, under these specific circumstances, this is true or this is false.
And it turns out that those specific circumstances can change the results. For example, in 2008, a researcher at Florida State University named E.J. Masacampo decided to test whether students at FSU would choose housing that was close to campus but small, or housing that was far from campus but large. It was supposed to be a difficult decision for the students, many of whom already drove to campus. The reproduction was attempted at the University of Virginia. Mallory Kidwell, the other project manager, explains.
For University of Virginia students where the replication was conducted, most of them do not drive, no, all. She went to, Johanna went to the University of Virginia. First years are required not to have a car, and the rest of students rarely drive to school. And using these materials where they were offered apartments that were 5 or 7 or I think 8 miles away, that was just absurd. Ridiculous. Yeah. And so, of course, they're going to choose the 5 miles because of all these terrible options.
Right. So for UVA students, it was an incredibly easy decision. Whereas when the original was conducted at Florida State, it was a decision that required some teasing out and some decision making. So the replication was not considered successful. But I think the original author and the replicators both hypothesized that it could be because of that difference in population.
Kidwell and Cahoon are quick to point out that failure does not necessarily mean the original study produced a false positive or that the data was fabricated, just that the results may only be accurate at FSU, not elsewhere. At this point, you might be thinking, why should I care how far students want to drive to campus and whether the answer is different from Florida to Virginia? The answer lies not in the study itself, but in the inability to reproduce it.
It's really important to recognize that a key aspect of science is a process of uncertainty reduction. No one study is definitive. You hear today that coffee is good for you. You hear tomorrow coffee is bad for you. Someday you hear coffee, well, we don't know. And that can feel very confusing.
That was Brian Nosek, director of the Center for Open Science. He said the point of the study was to try and develop reproducibility guidelines for scientific journals to adopt and to determine what factors influence failure to replicate.
It started because we don't know what the reproducibility rate is, and reproducibility is central to how science works. Science, a core assumption is that the work that is done, the evidence that is gained, is reproducible, that someone else could follow the same methods and obtain a similar result. But that's not guaranteed to be the case, especially when we're working at the boundaries of knowledge. We're investigating things we don't understand yet. So we're going to go down a lot of blind alleys. We're going to get a lot of initial evidence that doesn't turn out. And that's ordinary science. But because we don't know the frequency with which we're heading down alleys that are difficult to reproduce versus ones that are very robust, we just wanted to make sure that we investigate it. And then if we do find challenges, design ways to address it.
The final data from the Reproducibility Project was published Thursday in Science Magazine and argues that, while both kinds of research are important, the scientific community needs to shift from only publishing original research to encouraging replication.
So the key insight or reminder of this study is that each study that's done on a research question on a topic is one piece of evidence. And the real conclusion comes after accumulating evidence across many studies.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
For the past year, three volunteers have been leading Buddhism, yoga, and meditation classes for inmates at Goochland Women's Correctional Facility just outside of Richmond. And Kara Lofton got that story, too, sitting in on a session.
The women lie on their backs, hands up, eyes closed, in a circle around the volunteer playing Tibetan singing bowls. If not for the state-issued gray sweatpants and brightly colored shirts emblazoned with DOC workforce, this could be a guided meditation class anywhere, but it's not.
I've been incarcerated for coming up on 3 years. I've been at this facility for a year now. And I've got 4 months and 19 days left.
That was Sarah Goines, one of the inmates at Goochland Women's Correctional Facility, a minimum security prison outside of Richmond. She is one of about 20 women who regularly participate in Goochland's prison program. Those last three letters are Z-E-N, started last summer by yoga teacher Lori Shalin. Prison is run by volunteers, such as Lainey Gratz, who teach weekly Buddhism, yoga, and meditation classes to the inmates in an effort to provide them with, quote, mindfulness techniques that lead to forgiveness and compassion with the hopes of integrating these teachings upon their return to society. Over the past year, Gratz says the women have learned that meditation isn't as difficult as they thought and can be incredibly helpful in navigating the stress of incarceration.
The women realize that it's not such a difficult task. So they're able to really integrate it and enjoy the meditation as opposed to it being so challenging.
Gratz's class was very informal. Although she had an agenda, she didn't seem overly intent on following it, rather letting the women take ownership of the time and talk about topics that were important to them, such as, I'm getting out soon. Where do I find resources for Buddhism classes outside of the compound? And I'm going through a divorce. Do I fight my husband for half or let it go? What would Buddha do? Structured or not, the class seems to be making a difference.
I've been on the compound for 3.5 years, and this is my second time in prison. And first time I feel like I really didn't learn anything. I'm 37, and I act very immature and have 4 children. My oldest is 19, and my youngest is 11.
That's Brandy Pickles. She joined the Buddhism meditation class in August of last year at the urging of a friend.
Coming to Buddhism and practicing Buddhism and reading about it and stuff, between my family and myself and the people on the compound, I have seen a world of difference. I have changed so much, and my family has seen a big change in me, and it's changed my perception and so much stuff in me. I love it. I really, really enjoy it. It makes me stop and think.
Sarah Goines agrees.
My favorite part of the class really is it's really about the philosophy, about the way you treat other people, about how you can take whatever you're suffering with and turn it into good, or not just yourself, but for everyone around you. It's really been a huge stress reducer for me. I mean, because I've been here a year, and almost a year I've been doing this, and I don't think I would have been able to do it as gracefully as I have, because when I was doing my jail time, I was all over the place, you know, just internally. And here I'm just really calm and collected. It's really nice.
Do you think that it has changed the way you interact with people both inside the facility and outside?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even my family sees a huge difference in me. I've never been like a really angry person or anything, but my mom just sees my whole thinking has changed. I plan out things more. I don't get as frustrated with little things. I have a 7-year-old, so even he's just, he loves it that I'm doing the Buddhism, because I teach him little things or send him stuff that the class has given us, so he's really into it too. So it's cool.
The women here are non-violent, mostly drug-related offenders, and the vast majority will eventually go home. Their biggest challenge at this point is not getting out of prison, but learning the skills they need to stay out. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. Before you listen to this week's Spark, I'd like you to please remember that every musician who tops the charts was once a young nobody with ambition who was willing to work hard and risk falling flat on his face. With that in mind, I'd like to introduce you to recent college graduate Danny DeMaray, who's always been called Danny, but not always DeMaray.
I was told my whole life we pronounced it Damaris until I started talking to some friends who were French, and they're like, dude, your last name is DeMaray. You should say it like that. It's a lot cooler.
I met Danny at the City Rec Center gym. He's co-founder and guitarist for the Harrisonburg-centric band Too Indecent and has been focused on making a career out of non-classical music since the fifth grade. My first NPR editor told me always to ask musicians about their instruments. Yeah. Tell me about your guitar.
My actual guitar?
Your actual guitar.
It is a ESP Eclipse 2. It's all black with gold trim. I love it. I actually paid for that guitar before I ever even had a car. I was 14 in ninth grade working at Kroger grocery store, just spending all my money putting it away in my bank account, and then I finally got that guitar.
Your dream guitar.
Yeah.
You decide you want to be a musician. What kind of musician?
That's a hard question because when I first got my guitar, it was just like, I want to do anything I can. I wanted to learn every instrument, actually, but guitar was like the first one. I was like, all right, need to learn this one. And then after that, it was just always hard finding people to get in a band, finding other musicians that were down to be a group together. So that's when I started getting into a little bit more software music, you know, producing and stuff like that, started rapping over that, and it was a lot easier because it was just me making the music and writing it until I moved to college, and then I started actually meeting a bunch of other people that were into making music, and so we started doing some projects here and there, and then kind of just came up with Too Indecent.
I'm an old fuddy-duddy. What does starting rapping actually mean?
Oh, well, you've go to high school and you do a really bad job at rapping. That's how it starts.
So what is rap?
Rap is pretty much poetry in motion is what I like to call it. And a lot of that has gotten forgotten. But back then it was just pretty much writing a poem that can go over, you know, drums and bass. And when I first started, I was god awful at it. I mean, I'm just a white boy. I don't come from a hard background. Can't really relate to a lot of the rap music that is out there. But over time, you get better at storytelling, you get better at giving your perspective without just saying it right then and there. You get more artistic with it.
You invested your time, energy, effort, and money in a college education. What's that about?
I can thank my parents for that one. At first, it was so funny because I wanted to not go to college and make music full time and just work as well on the side. But my parents threatened to not pay for anything at that moment. They're like, we're not paying for your rent. We're not paying for your car bills. Mm-hmm. So they kind of pressured me to go to college. And I thank them for that because I met so many just wonderful people. I met all my bandmates now here at college. I think that was really cool. Other than that, it's a pretty expensive piece of paper that I got at the end of the 4 years. And I mean, it's good to fall back on. But currently, I'm not trying to get a full-time job anytime soon. I'm just a bartender in a town trying to make it big in the music industry. So right now, I mean, I'm trying to make my own job. Yeah.
Okay, you're sitting here in the WMRA interview room in a t-shirt talking to me, and you just said on a microphone, I want to make it big in the music business. And you don't strike me as somebody who just expects it to happen. So how do you see doing that? You got a plan?
Yeah, we actually got a 1 year, 5 year, 10 year plan, you know, all that good stuff. It's just taking initiative. That was like one thing I learned very early on is just if you want something, you don't wait for it. You go out and get it. You try every day. You wake up in the morning and you work towards it.
We're all
counting on the sun to go down. Please just go down. To go down.
Does any part of you have a plan B in case, you know, this doesn't happen?
Well, I have a college degree, so I'm not too worried. But really, the plan B is if this doesn't happen, like, let's say Too Indecent doesn't actually go to anything. I mean, I still want to be playing music for the rest of my life. I didn't sacrifice all this time and money to not. So pretty much my plan B is just starting another project or going somewhere in the music industry where I can still work with music. But that is like if I'm 50 and I'm about to be homeless and I can't do anything else with music, I'm going to take that plan B route.
What do your parents think of this? Are they at peace with it?
For the longest time, they've always been supportive. From day one, since I got a guitar, they loved me playing music. When I started saying I wanted to make a career out of it, they're like, well, you should keep your options open, you know, what any parent would say. But the more and more I got into it and the more like real that this dream has kind of become, filed for a business, we're LLC, and when they saw that, they're like, all right, this man knows what he's doing. So now they're really supportive about it all.
Tell me about this business aspect.
Well, that's the one thing I've learned at college is how to somewhat run a business. And I know it's not necessary right now because we're in such a young stage as a band, but I think it's better to just keep track of everything from the get-go.
You seem like you've thought this through, not just I'm creative and brilliant and I'm going to be famous.
Yeah.
Have you made any mistakes that you don't want to make again?
One mistake I can definitely name off the top of my head is taking every show that is offered to you. And we had an experience where we had a show in DC and we thought it was going to be a great show. Of course, we're like, yeah, we're going to do it. We've never played outside of Harrisonburg. This is our first chance to make it big in DC. And then we got to the show, realized the promoter wasn't even there. None of the bands got paid. It cost money just to drink water inside the venue. And after that, it was just kind of like, we can't be so blind and so naive to just accept everything that comes our way. So,
do you get contracts or have specific agreements now?
No.
Are you afraid people will withdraw their invitations?
Yeah, honestly, people get weird about contracts. And yep. I mean, we even got to draft up a contract for the band members of Too Indecent here pretty soon. Well, personally, I think the time we have here on Earth is all about what you want to get out of it. And if you want stability, you can go the easy route and get that by getting a job, having a house, getting steady income. But if you want excitement and adventure, I say screw it. Go out and do what you want to do. At least find out that you failed rather than just thinking about it your whole life. And that was my main thing. I didn't want to think back and be like, oh man, that could have been so cool. But now I'm here at my desk job, you know, stuff like that. And that was my main motivation from the beginning.
Danny Demaree and his Too Indecent band members are about to take their reggae rock hop sound to that music mecca of the Southeast, Athens, Georgia. And in case you're curious, I used only Too Indecent music in editing this piece. You'll find some Too Indecent pictures and a couple of YouTube links on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Like us on Facebook, do all that stuff. Check us out on Instagram. Too Indecent's the band name. Here, Danny Demaree's talking to you. Danny Demaree. Remember that.
Even if you don't.
Yeah, right?
I'm Chanel Verani, and this is Our Island Universe. How did the planets in our own solar system form? And why do we only have two gas giants, Jupiter and Saturn? New work is showing how you can just form a few behemoths from a swirling protoplanetary disk of gas and dust. Turns out, the key to making a gas giant is the same as making a snowman. You start with a small amount of snow, and you roll it up until you get a big ball, right? Well, the same is true for planets. This model, pebble accretion, says that planets grow from small grains through collision and is held together via static electricity. These pebbles then coalesce and continue to add more material, forming a rocky core. So you typically only have 1 to 4 gas giants, like Jupiter and Saturn, around a sun-like star. This model also produces a few ice giants, like Uranus and Neptune, in the right range of distances from its parent star. It also predicts that no large planets would have formed in the Kuiper Belt, that outer fringe where Pluto and its brethren hang out. Sorry, there is no Planet X or Planet Nibiru out there. So this winter, after the first snowfall, when you're outside making a snowman with the kids, remember that the same physics you use to make a large ball of snow explains how the planets in our solar system began to form 4.5 billion years ago. For the John C. Wells Planetarium, I'm Chanel Varani.
Finally, we'll end today with the vigil held Wednesday morning on the quad of James Madison University in memory of Roanoke-based WDBJ-TV news reporter and JMU alum Allison Parker. Parker and photojournalist Adam Ward were shot and killed a week ago last Wednesday by a former colleague during an early morning broadcast. Here's what the vigil sounded like, as Kara Lofton reported.
By 6:45 a.m., a bleary-faced crowd of James Madison University affiliates and community members had gathered in a semicircle on the university quad to honor Allison Parker's life and contribution to the university through a vigil. Parker was a 2012 graduate of JMU's School of Media Arts and Design.
It's my honor today to be able to lead us in a moment of celebrating a very promising woman and her life.
That was Brad Jenkins, general manager of JMU's student newspaper, The Breeze, for which Parker worked as a student.
In times like this, when life is snatched up in such a horrific way, we stammer as we search for words to make sense of such tragedy. Even those of us in the business of words have struggled the past week to describe our grief and our sadness. So then, our first response this morning will be to spend a moment in silence, honoring our friend and alumna.
The memorial service for Parker and fellow photojournalist Adam Ward was held privately on Sunday in Roanoke. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Janet Tretner, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. And you, too, can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning.